And good evening. It is Intuitive Soul Radio with your host, Lori Houston, Intuitive Soul, Clearing a Path to Divine Consciousness. And this is the author portion of our show tonight. And I am so pleased and honored to have Mama Donna Hennis, which is the author of The Queen of Myself, which I found as an amazing book because I have also seen the limitations of the tri-goddess theory or the triple goddess theory. So welcome, Mama Donna.
Thank you.
And I love the fact that you like to be called Mama Donna.
Well, it grew on me. I was dubbed that, and it just kind of took.
So you give a fair bit of your story in your book, but tell us, you know, a little bit about how you got to where you are now.
Oh, boy.
I know.
Let me see. For the last 35 years, I've been a professional shaman and spiritual counselor, ceremonialist. Specifically how I got to where I am in queendom, when I was nearing my 50th birthday, because I was a professional ceremonialist, I assumed that my 50th birthday would be worthy of an amazing ceremony. And you mentioned the triple goddess, and I just assumed it would be a croning because that's what women do when they reach their 50s. And I was fine with that until it really approached closely, and I balked. I seriously balked. I thought, excuse me, I'm not a crone. I'm not an old lady, and I'm still not an old lady, you know? And it just really rubbed me the wrong way, not because I don't want to get old. Quite the contrary. I want to get very, very, very old, considering the alternative, you know? but I'm not old yet. And, you know, we live so much longer these days. Yeah. I just thought it was really ludicrous to consider that I would be a crone, an old wise one, for half of my life.
Mm-hmm.
It just didn't make sense to me. So that's what started me thinking about all this. And then I realized I'm a baby boomer.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that, well, I'm not the only person in this situation. There are 60 million plus women in their mid-years right now. So I realized that if I was feeling that way, then it was really affecting a huge percentage of the population. And then that really called into question, what is an archetype?
Mm.
An archetype is supposed to be universal. So how could something be universal that leaves out 60 million people? You know? So that's what really started me. And I wasn't completely finished, but a really horrendous period of my life was just ending, where I spent almost 15 years deathing people, family, pets, best friends. In my professional capacity, women in my circles and clients and on. I just, oh my gosh, it was well over a decade where I used to kind of joke, it wasn't funny, but mm-hmm. you know, that my entire social life was with people who were lying down, you know? And I realized that, wow, you know, I got through that. And for me personally, the hardest single thing in all of that was diapering my mom.
Mm.
And I thought, you know what? If I could do this, I could do anything. I'm not a crone. I'm a queen. I rule. I'm powerful.
Mm.
And that's where the name queen came from. And I just kind of deconstructed the triple goddess and inserted another category that fits us.
Yeah.
Much better. Right now, in the United States, one-third of all women are over the age of 50.
Wow.
So that's a lot of women.
Mm-hmm.
And so the queen for me is after mothering. Of course, if you've been a mother, you're always a mother, but not in that, quite in that same 24/7 way. And we're not anywhere near being old yet. So what are we?
Yeah.
You know, and I think that we are in our prime. We are at the height of our power, and we're out in the world, and we have unprecedented responsibility and influence and cachet, and this is our time.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought the queen was a good way to signify that period.
No, I think it's brilliant because I think we're in a very unique time in culture, because really, you know, the goddess energy really has to be redefined, and we have to, you know, we've had very few examples of what this time means, and not just this time, but like the time for all women. We're coming into our power, we're coming into a more balanced state, and many of us have chosen not to have children, so never really fell into that mother
mm-hmm.
place, and yet, you know, we do need to sort of understand who we are and try and figure out how we fit into this. And so I think it's, you know, it doesn't just fit for those people that are over 50. There's a lot of us that are under that, you know, may still bleed, but not have that, you know, that whole mothering aspect, but have a, you know, a place that we're trying to figure out and understand.
Exactly. Exactly. An interesting thing also about the baby boom generation is that for the first time in the history of the world, almost a quarter of the women, given the choice, and thank goodness we still have the choice, but we were the first generation to have free access to birth control and abortion, given the choice, a quarter of us chose not to have children. That's really amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And although I like to feel that most women do have a mothering stage, mm-hmm. even if they had not given birth to babies.
Yes.
Because we give birth to other things
Absolutely.
That are also born of our passion. You know, mm-hmm. it could be a book, it can be a career, it can be a business, it can be a political association, it can be an art form. You know, and then it's something that you birth and then keep alive.
Yeah.
You know? So there is that kind of archetypal motherhood, you
yes.
know. But what happens, I think, in that queen stage is that we move away from wanting to nurture somebody or something else and have a very strong, literal, biologic urge to nurture ourselves.
Mm.
You know, whatever we haven't done or whatever we've neglected or a part of ourselves that we feel that we could have developed more, we're really drawn to do that now.
Yeah.
And that's what's so interesting. But you're right. We do need a way to identify ourselves, not to put ourselves in a box.
Right.
But an archetype is very helpful because it's like a role model. It gives us something to aspire to.
So you briefly mentioned the triple goddess. I mean, we have, you know, in mythology and her story, we have, you know, this image of the triple goddess beginning probably with, you know, Mother Earth and moving towards, you know, the crone. But it's explain a little bit about what the triple goddess is and then move into the fourfold goddess, which I think is great.
Oh, thanks, Laurie. Queen Laurie, I should say.
Uh-huh.
Well, the triple goddess is actually not as ancient as we have been led to believe. Many cultures have triple goddesses, that is, a triad of goddesses who are really more like sorority sisters. They are aligned because they have a common profession, if you will. You know, the Celts have the three warrior queens.
Mm-hmm.
The Hindus talk about three aspects of the goddess, and They call them the Three Sisters.
Right.
Women in Western culture who are identified with the triple goddess will often say that Sarasvati is the maiden, and Durga is the mother, and Kali is the crone. But if you know any Hindu people who worship these goddesses, they will not know what in the world you're talking about.
Right.
Because to them, they're the three sisters, and if you look at the iconography, there's no old, you know, Kali's not old.
No.
You know, they're all of an age, whatever, you know, an undescribed age, but none of them are really young, and none of them are really old.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same thing with the Greek goddesses. One of the things that most people in the States know, because we learned it in world mythology or whatever in junior high school, is the three fates.
Right.
And, you know, we've been told that the young fate spins the thread of life, and the middle fate measures the thread of life, and the old fate cuts the thread of life. But if you go to Greece and you look at those urns or the frescoes or anything, the three fates are always three young sprites dancing around an olive tree. There's no old sprite. There's no middle sprite. They're all, the fates are all, again, allied because they all are involved in a similar enterprise. So in my research, because I thought, you know, like all of us, oh, the triple goddess is ancient.
Mm-hmm.
Not so. Ironically and kind of unsettlingly, the triple goddess is younger than I am.
Oh.
The triple goddess, as age identified, maiden, mother, crone, was named maiden, mother, crone by, and his name is slipping right now, man, of course, Robert Graves, the White Goddess, which was published in 1948.
Wow.
So this is a totally new concept. It's not ancient at all, and it was invented by this guy. And he says that the triple goddess, and this is what we've all come to believe because this is what we've been told, and who knew, you know, that the three faces of the goddess correspond to the seasons and the elements. And the seasons, the elements, the time of the moon, and the phases of the moon and the times of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, excuse me, for, as I say, 35 years, I've been a ceremonialist, especially having to do with celebrating the cycles of the seasons. I know very well that there are four seasons, and everybody else knows this very well,
yeah,
too. And there are four phases of the moon. They're called quarters.
Mm-hmm.
You know? They're not called thirds. So something is really wrong here, you know. And then when I look deeper into it, he corresponds the maiden with air, which actually I take exception to because I think that the maidens are more aligned with water. They go with the flow of their own emotions. They don't really dam themselves and censor themselves. They live very close to their emotions because of their hormones. He also aligns them to the waxing moon, which makes sense, and dawn, which makes sense. You know, Homer's rosy-fingered dawn. And to springtime, all of which makes sense.
Right.
The mother, he corresponds with the full moon, with Earth, with summer, and high noon. And that all makes sense. The crone, he identifies with winter, with midnight, he says water for the crone, but I think the crone is air just because it's a more sophisticated macro, microcosmic kind of thinking. And let's see, did I say all of them? And winter. But he left off fall, which I think is the queen. I mean, this is our mature time of life. I mean, the year doesn't go from summer to winter. First, there's this fabulous fall, which we're experiencing right now, that's full of drama and color and excitement and reinvigoration. And the same thing for the evening. You know, unless you live smack on the equator, it doesn't go from noon to midnight. You know, first there's evening. And it's the same thing as fall in a way, you know. I mean, before the sun sets, it's just dramatic and gorgeous, as we are, I think, in our mid-years. And in terms of the element, he left off fire. And if women in their midlife are not about fire, they're not about anything. You know, our bodies are burning up alive. You know, we do become reinvigorated, re-impassioned. Some women actually for the first time, but others of us, you know, you get that verve back again, that, you know, you kind of run down a little bit at the end of your motherhood. And it just seems like too much responsibility. And, you know, as the queen, you kind of pop up again. Margaret Mead called it postmenopausal vigor. And our patience is fried to a crisp. And I you're probably too polite to ever say this, and I can't say it in actual words on the radio, but I can't tell you how many times I've heard women say something to the effect of, I don't have time for this. You know, and then, you know, the BS word in there, you know, because they just can't be bothered with the inessential. They're on their path, they're on the track, and they're too busy to be bothered with something unless it's important.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, isn't that weird? He left off women in their most powerful stage, and I don't know. I don't know whether we would ever know. I mean, was Robert Graves a misogynist? I don't know. But men in general are not threatened by maidens.
Right.
They like the maidens because they can tell them what to do. You know, mothers, the Madonna, you know, are honored. And everybody loves their grandmother.
Yeah.
But women in their midlife are harder to deal with because we say what we believe, we know what we know, we're not afraid to step forward. And of course, the pop culture has really exploited that in a very harmful way, I think. You know, we have now this kind of image of the menopausal maniac, you know. But men don't like that. They're threatened by the power of a mature woman.
Yeah.
So he left it out for whatever reason. And in all of my research and my thinking about this, I realized, well, you know what? A lot of goddess people assume that the Christian Trinity comes from the triple goddess, but I think it's not. I think it's just the opposite. I think that Graves was inspired by the Christian Trinity, and that four is a much more primal and universal number as a holy number. Most primal people, most indigenous people everywhere in the world have four as their holy number.
Mm.
Four is the directions that we can move without leaving the earth. You know, we can move forward, backward, or to either side. Anything else means we have to jump up or something, you know. So four becomes the directions, except in Chinese culture, most peoples have four elements and four seasons. Even, you know, other cultures that are not, or other environments that are not temperate have four seasons. They might not be our same four seasons, but they're the dry one or the wet one or the monsoon one or the windy one or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And undeniably, the moon has four parts in its cycle.
Right.
Four, actually, it has, you know, 28 parts, but it has four milestones in its cycle.
Right.
And so it seemed to me that if I added this other part, and if there were a goddess who had four faces, she would truly be aligned to the earth and the earth energy. and it would be just much easier to understand. I don't understand how we have the symbol of the moon, the three parts of the moon. You know, I just don't get it. And there's the goddess Hecate, I think, was originally a fourfold goddess because she's the goddess of the crossroads. Mm. Well, that implies an intersection of four byways, or two byways and four directions. And we see her head on and her two profiles, but I think that there's a face in the back and we just can't see it, just like the dark moon. It's there, we just can't see it.
Right.
So that is the
And it's very powerful,
goddess.
The one. I mean, the new moon is probably one of the most powerful of the moons.
Exactly. I mean, it's a very powerful time. And I just think it's very, very interesting. But, you know, when I wrote this book, there was a part of me, I mean, I'm a rebellion from way back, you know. but it occurred to me that I might be offending some traditional, as it were, triple goddess women.
Hmm.
And it's been anything but that. Mm-hmm. There were so many blurbs for this book by every goddess woman writer you've ever heard of. Everybody just jumped on it. And now there are goddess temples all over the world, and they have adopted the fourfold goddess and now have four altars, including one for the queen.
Nice.
So, yeah, it's just, you know, when something feels right, you mm-hmm. know, and I think that a lot of women just felt that it felt right, finally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's talk about the return to self, because I agree that, you know, when we don't become aware of who we are, we really are struggling in the drama and continuing the stories. So, you know, what does return to self mean? It means being authentic, but, you know, talk about what that means and what you assist women to do.
Well, it's interesting because we are hardwired to do this. When the hormones in our uterus start to weaken and leave us, we get other hormones. Well, actually, we've always had them, but they become empowered, as it were, in our brain, and they're called androgens. And they're about assertion. It's not testosterone. It's not about aggression.
Mm-hmm.
But it's about assertion. And it's about, you know, I mentioned the women who all say, you know, I don't have time for this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is one of the midlife mantras that I've been collecting. You know, if I hear 10,000 women say the same thing, I know that this is, you know, this is something that we all relate to. And another of these midlife mantras is, now it's my turn.
Mm.
Now it's my turn. You know, as the maiden, we have to be good girls and good daughters and good girlfriends and good students and so on. And as a mother or a boss or, you know, a professional woman in any field, we have responsibility out there, not just to ourselves. And now is the time that we really are drawn in just as strongly as we have a biological imperative. We have this urge to merge.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have this urge to nurture ourselves, to mother ourselves. And another four, besides all the directions and the seasons and the elements and so on, is the Jungian description of the self with a capital S, which is comprised of a mental, a physical, an emotional, and a spiritual aspect. And we all have all of them, but everybody has them developed in a different way. You know, obviously people are different, and some are more physical, and some are more mental, and so on. And what happens when we reach this age is we want to put all of our pieces together again.
Mm-hmm.
And as, you know, as a young woman, as a maiden, we have all sorts of possibility. Hopefully, ideally, girls are being raised with the notion that they can be and do anything that they want, you know, if they just, if they work for it and if they do diligence. But somewhere along the line, in the mothering stage, when we have so much responsibility, things get lost, they get sublimated, they get subjugated, they get denied for various reasons. You know, we don't have time, we don't have energy, we don't have money, we don't have moral support, we don't have courage, we don't have self-confidence, whatever. And so things get put off or left aside, and then we wake up in midlife and realize that the clock is ticking, and that even though hopefully, ideally, we all will live to be 100, at some point we will stop living. And that's one of the things that we lose as we age, is our innocent idea that we're immortal. And so all of a sudden we want to do what we want to do, and we want to be who we want to be. And most women have, you know, this movie, The Bucket List, things that people want to do before they die. A lot of women have a someday list. You know, someday I'm going to go to China. Someday I'm going to take ceramics classes. Someday I'm going to join the Peace Corps. Someday I'm going to learn Spanish, whatever it is. I'm going to finish this novel that I started, you know, in college. And this is someday.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the time to build ourselves again like a crazy quilt or like a puzzle, and pick up all the pieces that we've dropped or the stitches that we've dropped and put them back together again so that we become this totally whole, fulfilled, ideally, person. And there are all kinds of stories. It's like whatever you've done, you now want to do something else. You know, if you've been out in the business world, in the corporate world, where really you're living largely out of your mind, you really can't give in to all your emotions in the boardroom, then these women want to do something that is more spiritual or more life-affirming. You know, housewives want to go out into the world and work and do something, you know, bigger than domestic work. And women who've been in the work life, you know, fantasize about learning how to bake bread or whatever, you know, having a garden, learning how to knit. Women who have had children now in their empty nest get to really devote time and energy to their own desires. And women who haven't had children oftentimes want to do something. I know a woman who in her 50s was a very successful sculptor, and she had a career that was the envy of anybody who wanted to be an artist. I mean, she had all kinds of exhibits and galleries. She was in museums around the world. And at a certain point, some part of her wasn't fulfilled any longer by doing that. And she thought, you know, what am I going to do? One more opening, one more glass of bad wine, you know. I've done that. And she realized she really wanted a family, and she went to China and adopted a baby.
Mm.
And so this happens all the time. There was a woman that I met who was in her 60s who had been a very high-level corporate executive for many years and felt that she was just so burnt out. And she was saying, if I have to make one more decision, I'm going to scream. I just, you know, she just couldn't stand it, so she quit her job and got a job as an assistant in a daycare center, which she loved. It brought out her whole heart space, her spirituality. She said, they're like little puppies. They're just so cute, you know. And she was so happy. And, of course, having given up her huge career, she gave up a certain kind of style of life, but she could afford to have, you know, an entry-level, very low-paying job. But at this stage of life also, money becomes much less important. Things, objects, possessions become much less important, and fulfillment becomes much more important. Women who've been married for a really long time start to chafe at the bit, and there are a huge spike in divorce in midlife. And, of course, the movies, the TV programs would have it that it's the man who has the midlife crisis, and, you know, so what does he do? He leaves his wife, who made everything possible, runs off with his secretary, who's always young, who's always blonde, who's always thin. You know, they get into his red sports car, they stop at the drugstore for a refill of his Viagra, and they drive off into the sunset. And that's not really the case. Mm-hmm. Something like 70% of all midlife divorces are instigated by the woman. And not because of infidelity. It's because they literally, and my mother was one, they literally wake up one morning and go, oh, I really don't want to do this anymore. I want to see what it's like to have my own life.
Mm-hmm.
And they do. I met a woman, you know, I do these workshops all over, and one of the women just described her life as kind of like the Hollywood American dream. You know, she had a McMansion, and her kids went to Ivy League colleges, and she had a swimming pool, and they belonged to the country club, blah, blah, blah. She gets divorced, and her lifestyle really kind of plummets. And when I met her, she was living in a six-floor walk-up, one-room apartment in Buffalo, New York, and had never been happier. She says, I wake in the morning, and I say, okay, Suzanne, what would you like to do today? You know, and it's a joy. So it's very interesting. There's really this need. Women who, for example, I've heard a lot of stories similar to this, but this one woman was a very talented athlete as a young girl. And when she hit puberty, her father made her stop all her sports because he didn't want her to be a tomboy, and that wasn't ladylike. And, of course, today it's different. A girl can go to college on an athletic scholarship, but then it really wasn't the case. And this is what she was best in life at. This was her natural talent. Mm-hmm. And so it got pushed aside for 40 years. And she reached her 50s, and she took up Pilates, she took up tennis, and she started getting active on a physical level again and reclaiming her body as hers. And, of course, she's just really talented, and every ball she touches and every game she tries, she excels at because she's just naturally good at that. So it can go in any direction, but whatever it is, it's the common story is that women want to be well-rounded and fulfilled and, as you say, authentic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so... And you talk about, you know, more self-confidence, new intimacy, this cry for authenticity. And then you also put in quotation marks, the dangerous woman.
Yeah, because we say it like it is. It's all of a sudden, you know, it's literally one day you wake up and you realize, who said I have to do this? Who made these rules? I don't have to do this if I don't want to do it. It's just this revelation that comes upon us, and that's so liberating. And then that means we can do anything we want to do. I always have a caveat, as long as you don't hurt anybody. But you can, you know, who said you have to do whatever it is? Conduct a relationship in a certain way. Wear a certain kind of style, be all meek and polite, whatever. You don't have to do any of those things. And one of the things in these workshops that comes out a lot is that one thing that women are really afraid of in terms of aging is becoming invisible.
Mm.
And, you know, if you wear all beige and if you walk with your head down, you know what? You will be invisible. But you would be invisible at 15 also if that was your demeanor. And it's, you know, when you are liberated from these cans and cans and shoulds and boxes and all kinds of things, you're also free to express yourself in every way, whether it's through your fashion or through your personality or through actually demanding to be seen. And I don't know, I find it very, very, very interesting because in this stage of my life, I find that people really notice me more. And, you know, I live in New York City, and when I get on the subway, this is practically every single time, and this is not normal, somebody will stand up and give me a seat. And I'm not on crutches, thank goodness. You know, I'm not crippled, and I'm not old. But there's something, I don't know what it is. Just yesterday, I was kind of double parked. I was picking up a friend, and she had to run back into her house to get something. And so I was just sitting there. Some guy comes up to my window, knocks on the window of the car, and says, "I'm leaving. Do you want that parking space?" That never happens. I couldn't believe it. It was so nice. I mean, people will offer, I mean, to carry something for me or offer to do. I don't understand exactly what that is, except I think that there are women of a certain age who do walk on a red carpet, you know, who do model the queen. And I'm not talking about somebody demanding or a diva or a prima donna or anything like that. There's no excuse, you know, to be bad-mannered. But when women walk into a restaurant, either alone or with another woman, they, you know, they want to put you in the kitchen if they could. They put you in the bathroom if they were allowed, you know. And you don't have to do that. You don't have to accept that. All you have to do is say, you know what, I would prefer this table. And what are they going to do, argue with you? They'll say, certainly, madam, you know, or whatever. And they'll usher you to that table. This happened to me a couple weeks ago. It was my birthday, and I was taken out to dinner, and it was a nice place. And it was another woman who took me out, and they put us right at that service counter thing. I thought, you know, this is going to be a really nice meal. I don't want to sit with all the dirty silverware. I'm sorry. And I said something, and they put us at the bar for 5 minutes while they cleaned off another table, and we got a much better table.
Nice.
So we don't have to be afraid to say something. I would prefer this. You don't have to say, listen, young man, I, you know, whatever. And I think that if you just have this attitude that I am the queen of myself. People feel that. It's very interesting to me. Actually, there's an amazing book that's just about this. Doris Lessing, who just last year won the Nobel Prize for Literature, after having been shortlisted for 40 years. They finally gave it to her, you know, in her late 80s, and thank goodness she was still alive to appreciate it. She wrote a wonderful book called Summer Before the Dark. And it is about a woman in her midlife and in some fashion of a midlife crisis. She lives in the suburbs of London, and both of her children are now, as of that summer, out of the house. So she has an empty nest, and her husband has some kind of, I don't remember, some kind of conference or residency or something in the States, and so she's alone for the summer, and she moves into the city of London, And she is kind of battling a depression on, you know, getting older and thinking about all these things. And sometimes her depression would spill over into her dress. And she'd go out into the street and her hair wasn't really combed and, you know, she would look like a slob. And people practically bumped right into her. She was so invisible. And she started to notice this. And then on days when she felt much better and all perky and, you know, she did her hair and she put on a nice outfit and she walked out in the street with a kind of a bounce in her step, it was a totally different experience of being in the world. And she started to play with that. It's very interesting. But the whole idea of being invisible, I think, is something that we put on ourselves. And it's true. Our society is very youth-oriented. Mm. But remember, one out of three women is over 50. And we're visible in a much other kind of way, and we're not our grandmother's 50 either.
Mm-mm.
So that, you know, and now, of course, there's this whole thing about cougars and older women being sexy, and I don't know, maybe it's part of it, but you go to Europe, and somebody forgot to tell European women that as they age, they lose their sex appeal. So they don't know they're not supposed to be attractive or noticeable or whatever. So they are,
yeah.
You know, and you can sit in a cafe in Paris and there'll be two women in there having tea and pastries or whatever. And they're, you know, they can be 80 years old and they are coiffed and they are dressed and they're flirting with the waiters and they're charming and just beautiful. So that's, it's a very interesting thing. And I think that we can take charge of that experience.
Right. So you talk about embracing your majesty, and, you know, you say that there's no one truth and that you actually teach by example. And I like how you write that. You write it in your newsletters, you write in your book. You know, there, you can't show somebody how to be this person. It's really up to each individual how they express themselves and how that uniqueness comes through. But talk a little bit about that.
Well, that's exactly the case. I can't tell anybody what to do. And I don't know, I wouldn't know what to tell them, you know. It's your life. What do you want? What do you want to do? I'm good at helping elicit that from somebody's deep, you know, hidden self. But I, you know, it's not my business. It's not my job. It's not my ability to tell somebody what their life should be like. And I think it's all part of empowerment, you know. I think that's where my real interest is to help empower women. And again, I'm not empowering anybody. I'm just helping, inspiring, encouraging, supporting women to be their own true powerful self. You know, again, it's something I can't say, okay, you have to do this or you have to do that. But I find that there is, you know, even just the title of the book, The Queen of Myself, I notice whenever I say that, the woman that I'm talking to stands up just a little bit a little bit straighter. It's just, it's a great concept, mm-hmm. to be the queen of your own domain. And I think that it really appeals to women. Actually, in one of my workshops in Texas, in San Antonio, this woman said, "Midlife crisis? I'm not having a crisis. This is his crisis." You know, she's just running around doing all the things she always wanted to do. She said, she actually said that. She said, "For the first time in my life, I'm doing whatever I want to do."
Hmm.
And what can be more liberating than that? And when you do what you want to do and you don't get slapped down for it, then you're a little braver the next time and the next time and the next time. This woman in L.A. told a story. I was doing an evening thing, and she stopped for dinner on her way to the to the workshop, and she told the story, and this is something I think most people can relate to. She was in a restaurant, and there was a couple who was who were eating and drinking wine and very involved in each other. Meanwhile, their little boy was running all the way through the restaurant, yelling, knocking down chairs, really being totally obnoxious. And they didn't say anything. And, you know, that's horrible when that happens. And she came over to the table afterwards, and she said to the father, she said, you know, your son, I had to listen to your son for an hour and a half, and he completely ruined my dinner. So you can listen to me for the minute and a half that it takes me to tell you just how rude that was and how unfeeling and unthinking that was. And he actually apologized to her. And she was so blown away, and she said that was the first time in her life she ever spoke up to her for herself. And she said, and you know what? I could do it again now. She was so amazed at her audacity, but she wasn't mean. She didn't yell at him. You know, she just was very rational, and he heard her and apologized. Now, whether he'll, you know, keep his promise and never do that again or what, I don't know, but she was empowered by her own power. And, you know, that was just such a beautiful story. So, yes, that's all I can do is these stories. I feel like I'm kind of a Jane Appleseed, you know, that takes the experiences of women from different places and shares them with women in other places because they're so inspiring. And you feel, well, she can do it, I can do it. And then once you've done it, well, I did it once, I could do it again. And it becomes contagious. And so I think women are finding our power.
Yeah. What does taking charge mean? And a lot of times, you know, we are so trying to be in control of our lives that we don't often see that there are choices and opportunities for us to actually take charge of the responsibilities of how we feel and stuff. But talk a little bit about that, because you mentioned it earlier.
Well, something that I've been very interested in lately, and I think it will evolve probably into another book, is women, you know, I'm sort of thinking of it as you know, the Queen's Guide to Power. Because I was giving a talk at Omega Institute in upstate New York, and I was saying, just as part of everything else I was saying, that, you know, there are 60 million of us, and that we actually are the single biggest population in the United States. And if only we realized how much power we had, and if only we used it. And one woman piped up and said, and if only we weren't afraid of it. And I realized, you know, she's not just talking about herself, that this is a thing. This is a common thing. And so I did start to think about this and read about it and, you know, research about it. And women are afraid of our own power. We've been trained to be, you know, nice. We've been trained to be good. We've been trained to put everybody else before ourselves. And we also, I think, look at power differently. You know, we live in a culture that power means being powerful over, power through aggression, power through domination, power through intimidation or manipulation or exploitation. All these kind of powers are extremely common, and this is what we think of most often as being power. And there's another kind of power, though, which I call authentic power, which is the power from within. It's empowerment. And that's a whole different thing. And I think that that's what we have to encourage. We certainly don't want generations of women who act like they are full of testosterone. That's not my idea of women's liberation or human liberation. But we do have to question, what is power? And why am I afraid of it? And to me, the saddest thing is that women, even now, are very competitive with other women and cut each other down when we seem like we're acting and standing in our own power. And I find that very upsetting. Oprah once said something that I thought was the single saddest thing I've ever heard in my life. She said, the hardest part of being successful is finding somebody to be glad for you. And I think that's true. And I also think that that's sort of biologically ingrained in us, because all the way back to cave time, when women set out to reproduce, we wanted a powerful man, i.e. a powerful sperm. We wanted a healthy child that would live, and we wanted a strong man to provide for us and protect us when we were vulnerable, at our most vulnerable. Of course, that's not necessary any longer, but women are still attracted to powerful men. Unfortunately, not necessarily to nice men, but to powerful men. And then we've been raised to believe that, oh, and so why women are competitive is because they're all out for the alpha male. Even though we certainly don't think about it that way, oh, he's got better sperm, you know. But that is, I think, wired into us from long ago survival technique. And in terms of being powerful, we're afraid that men won't love us, because that's how we were raised. I was raised that way. When I would be walking out the door for a date, my mom would say to me something like, now, don't be too smart. Boys don't like that. I think she was wrong. I think men do like strong and powerful women, but men who are confident in themselves. And why would you want any other kind, you know? But it's also, I think, even more so that women are afraid of losing the love of other women. You know, Doris Lessing wrote about this too in the Golden Notebook, that through our lives and through our husbands or divorces or children or jobs or careers, it's our girlfriends who are really our rock bottom solid support. And we're afraid of losing that. So it's a very sad thing that on some level, and I think a lot of this is subliminal, women are afraid to exert their power because they're afraid that they will not be liked or loved or supported. So I think that this is changing. We have a lot of good role models lately. And I'm, not only are women more powerful in the world, which is amazing. I mean, there are more women heads of state now than ever have been, and on and on, you know, in business and sports, in every part of life. But I think also that the more women who are entering these fields, we're beginning to see a little bit of a change of how things are done. And that's, I think, really exciting. We don't want to be Condoleezza Rices who are really mimicking the way, you know, all the boys' rules. We want to have a more authentic kind of power that empowers others. And we do have a lot of role models for that. And I think that's, I mean, even when, and I'm missing her name right now, the Speaker of the House, what's her name, from California.
Sorry, I'm Canadian.
Oh, dear. Oh, why can't I remember her name? But all your listeners are going to know who I mean.
Yes.
When she was sworn into office, she had her right hand on the Bible and her left hand she was holding her 3-day-old granddaughter.
Aww.
Now, every man just about who is sworn into office of one kind or another has children or grandchildren. You would never see that. And what was her message was, is I stand for the law and I stand for the future.
Mm.
I stand for humanity. I stand for love. I stand for justice and I stand for love. That was an incredible show of a new way of being.
Yeah.
You know, and we have that. We have that. The president of Chile, when she was inaugurated, she had been abused and tortured and jailed during the Pinochet years. And he happened to be on trial for crimes against humanity during the same week of her inauguration. And her speech was, now is not the time for retribution and punishment. Now is the time for reconciliation, I'm quoting her now, and dare I say love.
Hmm.
Well, love in politics in the United States is a four-letter word. Nobody would say that. Nobody would say that.
Mm-hmm.
So there are other ways of doing things, and I think that it's just now coming out, you know? It's very exciting to me. I have a local bank here. And I went to open an account, and the bank manager was an African-American woman who is a queen age, somewhere in between 40 and 60. And she was just she carried herself like a queen. It was like she was very proud of her position and very glad to be in her position. 2 days after I opened this account, I got a card in the mail, a handwritten card.
Mm-hmm.
Saying, thank you very much. We appreciate your business. If there's anything I can do for you, do not hesitate to ask.
Mm-hmm.
And I went into her the next day, and I thanked her. I said, you've got a customer for life. And it cost you 5 minutes and a 37-cent stamp. And she said, I know. This is what I tell my staff. You know, it's all about human relations. So this is a new kind of power.
Mm-hmm.
And we the queens, you know, we rule by virtue of our virtue, I think, I hope.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mama Donna, you have been an inspiration, and it's been quite a joy talking with you. I'd love to have you back and talk more about this. Why don't we end with, I love how you call it a royal flush, and it's about strutting our stuff.
Well, that's the other fear that women have about aging, is that they will no longer be attractive or, you know, attract the sorts of attention that they want. And that is so untrue. It is so completely untrue. And I see that around me all the time. I've heard a thousand stories. It's just not true. It's the moment a woman feels empowered and lives and stands in her own center and likes herself, that's like the most powerful pheromone in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And she attracts all kinds of attention of whoever it is she wants to pay attention to her. And you know that. You walk into a room and you're attracted to a woman or a man who feels comfortable in their own skin. Again, I'm not talking about a show-off or a diva or whatever, but somebody who just feels comfortable and not ill at ease and not shy and not, you know, kind of looking miserable for being there. Those are the people that you want to talk to. And it's very interesting that, you know, I also do a lot of counseling that I call the midlife midwife, you know, to help women pass through this bumpy stage. And they'll often say, well, you know, when am I going to find a mate or a soulmate, or I want to get married again or whatever. And and I always tell them that their next love affair has to be with themselves. They have to really find a way to fall in love with themselves. Because really, let's face it, the one person that is absolutely guaranteed to be with you at your side until the day you die is you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And once you find that love for yourself, then the rest all falls into place.
Mm-hmm.
That's not why you do it, but that's what happens.
Indeed. So tell people how they can get a hold of you.
The website is www.thequeenofmyself.com. And I would invite everybody to visit this website because you can sign up there for the Queen's Chronicles, which is a monthly e-zine that's free. And it kind of picks up where the book leaves off. I hope it's a monthly dose of inspiration and encouragement and lots of interaction from other queens all over the place.
Nice.
And that's very lively. And you can get the book on the website or at Amazon or Barnes & Noble or ask for it at your local bookstore.
Nice. Well, again, it's been a great pleasure. I very much enjoyed this. You can probably talk for hours and keep everybody's attention. So it's been lovely.
I enjoyed it too. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.